You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS.
And Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, April 8th, 2014. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Gawler Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Zoe Carpenter asking the question, will phony populists hijack the fight against inequality? Also on the program today, it's Equal Pay Day. Two executive orders by President Obama to close the wage gap between men and women in this country. Chris Christie, one more tidbit I have to add because my daughter asks me every night about the latest Chris Christie news. Seems that there's not just one U.S. attorney investigating Chris Christie, but two. Also, Russia looking like it may invade eastern Ukraine, and a family values Republican congressman not so family value oriented, it seems. New evidence, at least out of Chicago. Well, you recall, Rahm Emanuel closed 50 public schools last year. That charter schools do not, in any shape or form, outperform public schools. Yet they are privately run and funded with tax dollars and take resources away from public schools. And a new poll shows exactly why the Democrats are in trouble in 2014. Their base voters do not plan to come out. Maybe Zoe Carpenter will have some ideas as to what could drive them out. And then we still got that story about sex ed in Mississippi. It's a heartwarming tale. We've also got a nice sound clip of Sean Hannity and Bob Beckel just outraged about the purported outrage. Well, I guess it's really it's the war on Easter. It's that time of year, folks. Senators in the U.S. Senate voted 59 to 38 yesterday to pass a bill restoring unemployment benefits that expired late last year. Six Republicans joined the Democratic caucus in voting to reinstate these or reauthorize emergency unemployment benefits for 5 months retroactively for long-term unemployed. This was a pay-for bill, which allowed for extending custom user fees through 2024 and allowing single-employer pension plans to prepay their flat-rate premiums, essentially something called pension smoothing. Nevertheless, it does not look like this bill will get a vote in the House. I know Democrats in the House are attempting to figure out a way in which to get the bill to the floor, but it's a tough road to hoe, as it were. But that, I'm sure, will also be one of the issues that we will be talking about as we go into the 2014 election. But an even, well, I guess even a broader question is just how much populist rhetoric is employed by those who really do not support any genuinely populist programs. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Zoe Carpenter. We are back, Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. Zoe Carpenter, a reporter for The Nation magazine based in Washington, D.C. Welcome to the program, Zoe.
Thanks for having me.
So let's talk about this. The give us a sense of what you mean when you talk about phony populists.
So I'm talking about Democrats who have great talk about tackling inequality and making that one of the party's priorities. But when you actually examine the agenda that they're promoting, much of that agenda is actually about a sort of modified trickle-down economics, embracing the energy of the private sector. And there's much reason to believe that that actually would worsen inequality and that it's merely an opportunistic ploy.
All right, well, let's get to that part about these type of trickle-down policies exacerbating the wealth inequality in this country, income inequality, I should say. But you use an example of President Obama in late January, speaking as to the issue of income inequality, but he did so in sort of an ironic context. Just tell us about that, because I think it is pretty illustrative.
Sure. So this was a meeting with a variety of CEOs regarding unemployment insurance for the long-term unemployed. As you probably know, the Republicans have resisted extending unemployment benefits for those who have been out of work for a long time. And so in an attempt to do something about that, the president asked several CEOs to sign a best practices pledge promising to hire or not to discriminate against those who have been unable to find work for a long time, which, you know, is all well and good. However, if you look at the CEOs who are in the room, we have Don Thompson, the CEO of McDonald's, whose restaurant workers are paid so little that they have to rely on, you know, over $1 billion in public assistance each year just to get by. Also, Jim McNerney of Boeing, who earned more than $23 million last year, but also threatened to move his company to a right-to-work state if the machinist union did not accept a pay freeze and a pension cut and things like that. So Obama was praising these CEOs for their participation in this unemployment plan and, you know, celebrating their participation with no sense of acknowledgement that their practices directly hurt workers and have led to the huge gap between workers and CEOs.
And you say that it very neatly illustrates the Democratic Party's current predicament. I mean, where else do we see examples of this talk the talk but not necessarily walk the walk? Or I should say, you know, before we get there, I mean, what do you think goes on in the minds of the administration. I mean, even as a sales job for some type of populism, this seems to be a little bit tin ear-ish. Or is it simply, I mean, how calibrated, I mean, are they trying to put on this image? And do Democrats attempt to use this sort of veneer of populism? Because this isn't, you know, I guess that picture of the CEOs saying that we're, you know, we're going to vaguely commit to not discriminating against long-term unemployed to give them really crappy jobs. How much does the White House think that this is projecting a populist vision?
You know, I'm not sure about their motivations exactly. I think that the administration's desire to do something about inequality is really sincere, and that's true for the majority of the Democratic Party. However, I think that there's also an attempt to repackage these Rubenomic-esque ideas into this new framework of concern for inequality and populism. And I think it's pretty clear that there's tremendous pressure to address inequality, that it's an opportunity and both a challenge that the party has to take on right now. I don't think it's something that can be avoided. But it's very inconvenient for the center of the party if they have to, if this sort of anti-inequality agenda challenges their core beliefs about the free market, which it seems to do.
Yeah, well, I mean, let's talk about Chuck Schumer. He's another guy who sort of seems to have, you know, hold these two notions in his head. And I have to say, let's talk about that. I don't want to get ahead of myself here.
Sure. So Chuck Schumer, he's the third-ranking Democrat in the Senate, and he's one of the party's biggest recipients of Wall Street campaign donations. And he has been really forcefully behind a populist approach to campaigning this year. So he thinks the Democrats should campaign on a handful of simple, straightforward principles of support for working families. College affordability, raising the minimum wage, extended unemployment insurance, equal pay for women, those are some of the things that he's advocated for. And we're seeing those pop up now in the Senate. The Senate is holding votes on a lot of these measures, which won't pass because of Republican filibusters, but it's a great campaign speech. However, Schumer, you know, his ties with Wall Street and his actions around financial deregulation in the past sort of makes one question his real commitment to fundamentally changing the structures of an economy that doesn't work for everyone.
Well, I mean, so when you talk about phony populists, I mean, this is sort of, is he a phony populist, or, I mean, is this sort of just a, are you really trying to express a dilemma here that, one, there's sincere desire to deal with income inequality, but the mechanisms are flawed?
I think it's there are examples of both in this piece. Schumer might be more an example of the latter, but then you have someone like you know, the Google chairman Eric Schmidt, who laid out an inequality agenda, which the third pillar of which has to do with special treatment for the tech sector, and so that's clearly opportunistic, and that's clearly phony, since we know that the tech sector is one of the best examples right now of American inequality.
And so, I mean, let's talk about that that tech sector solutions for inequality.
Sure. So the tech sector, you know, the Silicon Valley elite are getting more involved in politics, particularly Democratic politics. They're one of the emerging power centers of the party. And, you know, we see people like Ro Khanna, who's running for Congress in California, speaking the language of the new populism, talking about support for working people, but it's not actually clear that that they would do anything for working people that required them to sacrifice some of their special privileges. And, you know, someone like Jack Dorsey, who's a Twitter co-founder, he has acknowledged that the tech companies bear some responsibility for the economic divide in the Valley, But he seems sort of oblivious to the scale of inequality, saying that one of the countermeasures he's most proud of is picking up trash in the neighborhood. There's this sort of disconnect between rhetoric and reality, I think.
Yeah, and so, I mean, when you talk about the level of sincerity of the Obama administration, I'm just using them as an example, but they are concerned about income inequality, but it seems to me that surely they must have access to the same data that you and I have. You mentioned in your piece, you speak to Joseph Stiglitz. When he outlines the things that need to be done to address income inequality, what does he outline? I mean, what is the, for those people who, I mean, it seems to me there's two types of people here, or three types, right? One is those people who are genuinely concerned about income inequality and talk about larger structural forces and perceive the need for those changes. One, the Obama administration, which you know, by your assessment, is sincere about income inequality, but ignores those aspects of it for sort of more small bore things. And then the sort of the third group, which talks about income inequality because it is expedient. I mean, when people are talking about those structural changes, what are they talking about?
So I think to get down to that core difference, what's really happening is that the two sides are explaining things in different ways. So when someone like Stiglitz talks about inequality, or Senator Elizabeth Warren, for example, they see the massive gains at the top as being connected fundamentally to losses at the middle and at the bottom. So the kinds of solutions they would advocate for would affect people at the top. It would stop the flow of wealth, the appropriation of wealth to the top. Now, when someone like Obama talks about inequality, or certainly the Silicon Valley moguls, the way they tend to do it is by explaining losses at the middle and the bottom as being disconnected from the top, that it's something that happened to us, that globalization and technology have disadvantaged the American worker. And this allows them to promote solutions, job training, for example, education, which are good, but they wouldn't trouble the 1%, and they really wouldn't reverse the flow of wealth from workers to their bosses.
Right. I mean, it wouldn't diminish income inequality, in other words.
Right. It would be sort of a Band-Aid. It would be better, perhaps, than it is now to raise the minimum wage, for example. We certainly should do that. But that's not going to stop the fact that CEOs are making hundreds of times what workers would be, even if they earn $10.10 an hour.
And so one of the things you point out is really the dilemma here is, are there any Democrats who are willing to engage in what at least some of us perceive is an ongoing class war?
Yes, there are Democrats who are pushing back against this notion of inequality as something that just happened to America, and are saying instead, no, look, this is a deliberate policy choice, and we have to change our policies in order to fix inequality in a big way. People like Sherrod Brown, who won a very tough election race in Ohio with a pro-labor message, and he certainly spared few harsh words for financial interests, and he was pretty clear about that message, and he told me that he thinks that Democrats should be braver about standing up to accusations of class warfare, because, you know, it's pretty clear that the class warfare is already happening, and, you know, as Warren Buffett said, the 1%, they're winning. And so, effectively, you're choosing sides by opting out.
And so what, I mean, you know, so what can be done in this instance? I mean, you know, if there is a broad awareness of income inequality as a problem, but and it seems to me, you know, at least the I don't know if the preponderance of Democrats, but certainly at the highest levels, there's a sense of that this can be fixed with a mix of proposals that will enhance the bottom without touching the top. in some way, as if we can just sort of make this pie just keep growing and growing despite the fact that gains are being made by one end and not the other. How does this come about? In other words, if everybody's accepted the proposition, either for cynical or more benevolent reasons of income inequality, but the assessments of what causes it are different, how is that argument won politically?
I think it has to be won first popularly. I think we need a broader movement from the streets that can really convince elected officials and politicians that the people are ready for stronger stuff, right? Minimum wage, that polls well, not only for Democrats, but also for Republicans, and a whole host of other sort of small bore populist measures is already really popular. So I think the energy is out there to keep moving in that direction. I think people are eager to hear something new. And, certainly it's a significant challenge. There hasn't been something post-Occupy that can that seems that broad in scope in terms of economic justice. But this really is about justice. And in that sense, I think people are ready for a story that really clearly lays out who the champions are and who the villains are, perhaps.
And what do you make of President Obama's sort of rhetorical, I guess, transition from income inequality to opportunity?
I think that's just a way of muddying the waters. If you're talking about building opportunity, that's something that's vaguer. What is opportunity? It moves one away from the structural critiques of the economy. And so I think it's just a response to the sort of freak out about class warfare. And I think it's misguided.
Yeah, I mean, it is. I mean, it seems to me that the last thing you'd want to do going into an off-year election, when we have now poll after poll showing that the Democratic base is planning on staying home, or at least in larger numbers than it did in 2012, why would you want to muddy the waters?
I don't know, and that's a good question. And just to clarify, opportunity is important. That is something fundamental to our self-conception as Americans, the idea that even if you're born poor, if you're born unequal, you should have the opportunity to move up. So it's not that opportunity isn't a good thing to aspire to. It just seems like the rhetorical switch is more a cover for a softer policy stance.
Do you have a sense of where the biggest pushes for genuine populism are coming from within the Democratic Party, or at least the left, more broadly speaking?
Well, I think right now the minimum wage is really the strongest push, and that's really because that's where the strongest grassroots action has been lately. The Democrats embraced the minimum wage this year not because some strategist came up with it out of the blue. They were harnessing power that was coming from low-wage workers who walked off the job in hundreds of cities across the country, right? So places where there is activism building is where the momentum is going to come from, I think. We're seeing some other movement around foreclosure prevention. I think there's real untapped opportunity around student loan debt forgiveness. Students and millennials in general are completely shaped by the inequality crisis, and that could be a really good fertile ground for building youth movement around the issue.
You know, I mean, one of the things that frustrates me, I mean, I caught this quote by Governor Cuomo in this state, who is, I think sort of could be a poster child for the sort of, and I don't even know if he even rates as a phony populist, if he even is sort of even putting on that much of a pretense. But he wrote, some people have a very, or he said in response to, I guess, a progressive pushback on his budget, he said, some people have a very narrow definition and define progressive as public finance, which I do support, which unfortunately we don't have to pass the votes. But if you look at this budget and you look at these 4 years, it's been an extraordinary progressive accomplishment. I mean, this is a guy who it would be almost impossible to sort of delineate the Pataki sort of economic plan from the Cuomo economic plan in this state. Why isn't there seemingly a broader understanding? I mean, is there a lack of understanding amongst the sort of the population in general as to how these forces connect? I mean, does it make sense? I'm asking, is it sort of like the policies that he's implemented have been, you know, they have ads in New York touting that if you're a business, you come to New York, you won't pay taxes for 10 years. What is keeping the message from getting to a broader amount of people, do you think?
Well, we have a really strong ideology about the private sector being the savior of workers and being the savior of the economy. And, you know, for decades now, there has been a slow and very steady and very effective campaign to discredit government action. And I think that's really coming into play here, is that it's almost impossible to think of the government as a solution to anything rather than just a source of problems. And, you know, we seem to have forgotten the lessons of the WPA and the rest of the New Deal when it comes to the government's ability to really make a difference in people's lives and in the economy. And, of course, also we have a system, a political system, that's ruled by money. Economic inequality translates directly into political inequality and vice versa. And so I think that's another issue here, is that the people buying those ads that you mentioned are the ones with an interest in maintaining a status quo in which only a few people have the money and only a few people are empowered in the political system.
Zoe Carpenter from Nation Magazine, will phony populists hijack the fight against inequality? I think the quick answer is yeah. They will. But hopefully we'll push back. I appreciate you coming on and talking about this piece.
Thanks for having me.
All right, folks. Let me just talk about this this poll that just came out. And it's not telling us anything radically different than what we've seen in the past about what we know in terms of what's going to happen with the Democratic base. Now, I've just lost that piece of paper, actually. I just had it here in front of me, but, oh, here it is. Apparently, Democracy Corps did a poll for Women's Voices, Women Vote. And Democracy Corps is a Democratic shop. So
Carville Greenberg.
Right. And so, you know, you take that for what it's worth. When they look at the what they call the rising American electorate, that's unmarried women, young voters, and minorities, they have found that they are significantly less likely to vote in 2014 than other voters, non-RAE voters. The poll finds 64% of RAE voters who voted in 2012 say they are almost certain to vote in 2014. Meanwhile, 79% of non-single women, non-young people, non-minorities who voted in 2012 say they are almost certain to vote this year. That's a 15-point difference. This is what we saw in that Florida 13 race from a month ago or so, where people started freaking out. This is the fundamental problem that the Democrats have. It's not Obamacare. It's not anything other than the fact that they are not putting anything on the table that are going to drive their primary constituency to the polling places. Among the voters who will drop off from 2012 and not vote in 2014, Democrats hold an edge of 16 points. So in other words, voters who are more likely to stay home are overwhelmingly Democratic voters. This is a real problem for the Democratic Party. In saying that, what I'm saying is this is a real problem for maintaining a Democratic majority in the Senate, which is a real problem because I don't think that there is anybody more inclined to deal with a Republican-controlled Senate and a Republican-controlled House than President Obama. by all accounts, despite the fact that he took it out of his budget this year, the president is still pining over so-called entitlement, so-called reform. And to have a Republican-controlled Senate and a Republican-controlled House is a perfect situation for a Democratic president who can, who wants to have that grand bargain. Not to mention the implications for filling the judiciary, et cetera, et cetera. There are issues, I mean, some of them came up in that interview with Zoe Carpenter that are favored strongly by elements of the rising American electorate, as they call it. 94% of unmarried women favor a combination of pay equity and protections, ensuring insurance companies no longer charge women more than men. 75% of unmarried women favor a combination of pay equity, increasing the minimum wage. But, and apparently it's single women are an increasingly key constituency within that RAE group. But the Democrats have to figure out how to put something else on the table that is going to bring their voters out. And it would be sad to learn that lesson that Mark Begich is teaching the Democrats in Alaska, to learn it after the election. All right, let's go to this sound from, it's completely unrelated, but it is a little bit of War on Easter-ish. And I found it quite enjoyable.
There's something very important in this clip that we'll explain after it, but there's something about the nature of the war on Christmas versus the war on Easter that is revealed in this clip.
Really?
Indeed.
All right. All right, this is from the Sean Hannity show. Apparently he has invited on to his program a man named Majed Mugni, who is a parent in a class in Michigan. And he complained to school officials because a flyer was handed out in school to all the school kids from a church inviting them to an Easter egg hunt. All right, let's start this clip from the beginning.
Pastor of the church, as well as the school district, have both said this is not a religious event, just a day of activity for the community. Joining me now is the parent and attorney.
Pause. I like how the pastor of the church says that this Easter egg hunt at the church is not going to be a religious event. However, how many moments ago was Sean Hannity probably talking about how Hobby Lobby, where a CEO happens to be Christian, it is against his religion to have his employees get health insurance that provides contraception. That's a religious event. But the church, the pastor himself, presumably of the church, says this Easter egg hunt is not a religious event.
Majed Mugni is with us and the co-host of The Five, Bob Beckel. What's your complaint here, Majed?
Mr. Hannity, I just love how mainstream media puts a twist on a story. First of all, you probably got the wrong fish in your audience. If you're trying to sit here and try to get a Muslim to come up in front of you and tell you how radical we are, you just picked the wrong Muslim. The Muslim in front of you, sir, is one who stood up.
Why are you so angry? All I did was ask you why you're against it.
The Muslim in front of you. Well, let me tell you what the media has put a nice spin on the story.
Why don't you stop whining about it and tell us why you're complaining? What's the big deal? Just I asked you to tell us.
I'm going to tell you right now.
Good,
the story is, I'm a parent. You have a church who's decided to pass out flyers to 7- and 9-year-old elementary school kids and invite them to a church event. Well, I have a problem.
They said it's not a church event. It's an Easter egg hunt. So what?
It's distributed by a church. If that church...
Now, what's stunning is how much these guys like Hannity will talk about the oppression that Christians suffer in this country. But the idea that an Easter egg hunt at a church is not a religious event, is Sean Hannity aware that people who do not subscribe to the Christian religion perceive Easter as a religious holiday, and that the Easter egg hunt to celebrate Easter is a religious event?
Why are you so angry?
Continue.
Church wants to invite my kids. They can come through the front door, knock on my door, and say, we'd like to invite your kids. They don't have to stick a flyer inside my kids' backpack.
Of a stupid Easter egg hunt? You got to be kidding me.
I'm not outraged. Like I said, Mr. Hannity, you
seem
picked
outraged.
The wrong fish.
You seem angry.
You picked the wrong fit. You know why I'm outraged?
Why
I'm
are you
outraged? Because every time Arab Americans stand up for our rights, you guys hide the story and you don't show it.
Who's you guys?
The entire media.
The entire media.
When I stood up again, for four Christians in Durban who were falsely arrested, what did you guys do? Did you guys cover the story? No, I held a protest. I paid money out of my own pocket.
They have relay races and egg toss at an Easter egg hunt.
They were falsely arrested, and you guys didn't cover the story.
You're flipping out. You're losing your mind.
Right, I'm not flipping up. I stood up, and I held a protest.
Now let's get into the voice of reason. Bob Beckel, who is on the five. Obviously, he's a Fox contributor. He's got to go on sometimes the prime time. They bring him in when they need somebody to bash Muslims. Here's Bob Beckel, famous for both being the running the campaign for Walter Mondale back in 1984, and also getting busted, or not busted, but attempted extorted by a hooker back in 2002. Let's go.
Against terrorism, and you know,
if I could just interrupt you for a second, I'm delighted to hear that you stood up for the Christians, because it has been appalling to me that the Muslim community, both in the United States and certainly overseas, the presidents of every Muslim nation, the radicals certainly, but the mainstream Muslims, supposedly moderate Muslims, have said nothing. When children get bombed at Boston Marathon, when the coal gets blown up, when the World Trade Center, nothing is ever said. And the only thing you can conclude from that is most Muslims are either complicit in it, they agree with what these radicals are doing, or they're cowards.
So we have a guy who's brought on to make it look like Muslims are all outraged and angry and whiny people because they don't want a religious event to be their kids to get religious flyers in their school. And Bob Beckel's first comments are about how all the Muslims don't. Where's all the moms talking about if we're getting into terrorism? Now, of course, all you need to do is Google Muslim religious leaders speak out against terrorism, and you will find thousands of citations of this. Well, I have multiple interns who look at.
I asked the young lady in the office, and she was there. She helped, and she looked, and I was there, and then I said something. Anyways, long story short, we went to the HR together because of something I supposedly did. But there was no citation found ever.
I have interns who look at this thing, and I said, find me some Muslim in the day, and they couldn't do it.
So I wonder why you won't say that, but I am glad to hear you say that you don't hate the Christians, but she didn't find it. But she didn't find other things, too, because she was an idiot. So who knows?
All right, you know what? Let's take a break. We'll play the rest of this audio in the next segment because we're hitting up against the break here, and we've got a lot more to say about Bob
Beckel. You want to hear this in the better half. This is a great example of why you should become a member in the fun half. Excuse me. And what a perfect tease for the fun half in the middle of a funny bit.
Yeah, I know.
What's going on here?
All right. Folks, you can support this program by becoming a member today at majority.fm. You can also, if you buy crap through Amazon, you can buy it through our link at majoritireportkickback.com, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Reminder, tomorrow will be a Matt and Mike Wednesday, And then I will be live Thursday and Friday from Mass Torts Convention in Las Vegas. We'll be right back. Number 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920. We'll be right back after this.